All right, all right. Good morning, y'all. This is Brother A-Dub down here on the higher ground that Stevie Wonder was just singing about. I'm so glad that I got one more chance to take full advantage of my opportunity to live in this wonderful, wonderful creation that we have been given. We are surrounded by miracles every single day. We're surrounded by so many miracles that you can become complacent and forget that they're happening around you every single day, that you are a miracle. You are one in a million, as Aaliyah used to say. Of all those, what do you call them, zygotes or whatever you call them, them cells that made it to fertilize the egg that you are that one. You are that special one out of a million, and you should be basking in that miracle. So listen, y'all, the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speaker. They do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. You can give me a call down here at 217-359-5483, or you can try 217-359-6545. Today is going to be a very, very interesting conversation about job opportunities in the building trades as we work to diversify the building trades, as well as my guest this morning will be Durrell Cruz, Chris Evans, and Martell Miller talking about the IDOT traffic stop data in the city of Urbana, aka racial profiling in the city of Urbana, where yours truly is the alderman of Ward 3. So we're trying to turn up the heat down here a little bit this morning, and I definitely need your support, your enthusiasm. So call up a friend, call up a relative, wake your son up who's probably still in his room sleeping, and tell him to listen to his daddy on the radio and contribute to the conversation. So I'm going to make a couple of announcements. Again, I want you all to feel free to give me a call on the fly live, 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. Let's see what I have here. So the first announcement that I want to make this morning is that there will be a car wash benefit for Teron Jackson, the young man who was senselessly gunned down over in the Garden Hills area earlier this week. He was shot and killed, and all of the outpour of love and support for this young man, and everyone talking about if there was ever a situation of an innocent bystander, that is indeed what this situation is, that he was certainly not involved in any nonsense that was going on out there. But the benefit, there's been an outpouring of support for this family and this young man. And most of us, you know, have not made plans to bury our children. So most of us certainly do not have insurance, life insurance, and burial insurance for our children. So there's a fund, GoFundMe piece that that the family has put together for the young man, as well as today there's going to be a car wash benefit for Teron from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Family Video on Madison Bradley. That's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Family Video on Madison Bradley. There's no set cost. People are just accepting donations. But there'll be folks out there washing cars, trying to help raise money to bury the young man. So there's a memorial fund set up at the U of I Credit Union. And you can do that at either branch, but it is cash only. You'd have to donate cash into the U of I Credit Union on East University, South First Street, or the one that's in the union on campus. So either U of I Credit Union branch will accept cash only for the Teron Jackson Memorial Fund, whether it's East University, South First Street, or the union on campus. So there's several different ways that you can give to help this family through this tough time and to help bury this young man. It's hard to even think about that, burying somebody else. And so we're trying to do whatever we can to help the family and to help the community there heal and try to continue to move forward. So please go get your car washed, get your truck cleaned up, take your bicycle over there. I don't care. is a car wash to benefit Teron Jackson from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. today at the Family Video on Mattis and Bradley. So please go by there and make a donation and also get your vehicle cleaned up. If you just want to make a donation, you can do that there or at the U of I Credit Union, either branch, but it would be cash only at those places. Also tonight, Brian Doliner and Jason Patterson have a wonderful event planned at the Independent Media Center starting around 7:30 p.m. It's a art display as well as a book talk from Brian. So the Jason Patterson will be doing the art display. He's a local young man who's very, very talented and who will be sharing basically an African-American narrative through his through art. And Brian's will be talking about his book as well. It's going to be a very enlightening experience. BD or somebody, if you're listening out there, if you want to call and share some more details about what's going to take place at the IMC tonight, please feel free to do so. But I will be there. Definitely will have my family there. It's going to be a great experience for us to understand our history and also to see some very extraordinary art on display. So please come by the Independent Media Center tonight at 7:30 p.m. That's 202 South Broadway in Urbana. Let's see, what else do we have? Of course, the farmer's market is going on. It's a beautiful Saturday morning. It's not too hot, especially if you're up early right now. Now, all those folks who are at the farmer's market right now, they're not listening to my show. I think I need to get WEFT at the market. That's what we need to do so that we can have the show being broadcast from the at the farmer's market when they are open down there on at the Lincoln Square Mall on the corner of Vine and Vine Street. Let's just go with Vine Street, but you all know where Lincoln Square Mall is. So get down there and get you some fresh produce. After you get done listening to the show, head over there and get you some fresh produce. Or go get your car washed, then go get you some fresh produce. However you make it happen, those are the several different things that are taking place in our community right now, today, that you can be a part of. So I think that's it that I have for announcements today. I'll have some individuals from CU Citizens coming on this morning, so I'll find out for sure whether or not the meeting will take place at 4 o'clock today. But certainly, whatever you're doing out there, don't underestimate what you bring to the table and the value of what you bring to the table. So get involved, bring your expertise, your passion, your energy, your creativity, your imagination to an organization, create your own organization and do something, but make sure you can say today, this is what I contributed to my community to make it better. This is what I did to make it better. All right. And there can be addition by subtraction. If you know you're doing a bunch of stuff out there that you shouldn't be doing, don't do it. And that's, you can add something to your community by subtracting that negativity or that drama that you bring into your community. Trying to see what else we have here for announcements. I'm going to go ahead and do my underwriting now because we're going to have some pretty good conversation going, and I want to try to keep that flowing. So, Kevin Elliott Counseling. This hour of programming is brought to you by Kevin Elliott Counseling, with a diverse group of 30 licensed therapists providing individual, group, family, and marital therapy. Kevin Elliott Counseling is located at 309 West Clark Street near downtown Champaign. For more information, call 217-398-9066 or see Kevin Elliott, ELLIOTT, counseling.com. Again, for more information, call 217-398-9066 or visit Kevin Elliott Counseling located at 309 West Clark Street near downtown. And from you can also email them at kevinelliott.com, ELLIOTT counseling.com. Thank you all very much for supporting us down here at WEFT. We need all the support we can get. It's a community radio station, and if we don't have community to support it, it's not a community radio station. So thank you all for underwriting the program. Oh, I just love it in the morning. As soon as I get on the radio, people start texting. I'm sure this is my wife telling me, hey, let me tell you what to talk about today. All right. Just reminding you, 217-359-5483 is the phone number down here, or 217-359-6545 is also how you can be a part of this conversation. So this morning, I was supposed to have on with me some members of the organization, or the group of people that we've been working on a project called Pathways to Building Trades Apprenticeship. There's not, I guess it's not a program what we're working on. It's an actual informational fair. So I want to just say to everybody by way of announcement that the fair, this informational fair is going to be July 29th, excuse me, 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. Actually, registration is going to start from like at 1 o'clock. So if you want to get there at 1 to 1:30 for registration, then that would be ideal. The actual session will be from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. at Douglas Library in the conference room at 512 East Grove Street in Champaign. So you can learn how to get that important apprenticeship that'll lead to a promising career in the construction industry. This is going to be sponsored by the National Council of African American Men, the State Representative Carol Ammon's office, the NAACP, the East Central Illinois Building Trades, as well as the AFL-CIO. This is a bunch of information, and the Breakfast Club is also sponsoring this. Of course, there's a lot of conversation going around in the community about the North End Breakfast Club, but we're going to continue to stay at work doing all the amazing things that we've been doing, and we're not going to be defined by anything but the work that we do. So this very important apprenticeship fair. Now, it's not a job fair. Everybody out there listening, you should fully understand this is not a jobs fair. So you're not going to show up there with your resume and hopefully walk away with a job. That's not how this is going to work. Because of our the need for more diversity in the building trades, and what we're talking about is electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, carpenters, painters, iron workers. Those are your building trades, the laborers. These are the building trades, the people who make $23, $24, $34, $35, $45 an hour, building buildings, putting in our streets and infrastructure and things like that. That's what we're talking about here. So because the African-American community in particular is not represented the way that it should be within the building trades, we are partnering with the East Central Illinois Building Trades, the National Council of African American Men, the Breakfast Club. We are partnering with Carol's office to facilitate a responsible step forward towards having the trades represent the diversity that our community actually has. And so the East Central Illinois Building Trades, President Matt Langendorf and the AFL-CIO representative Jason Keller, and the laborers representation Deirdre Darnell and Byron Clark, president of National Council of African American Men. We've been meeting. We've been having phone conferences for the past month to try to pull this together. There are going to be radio ads and all kind of stuff coming up about this event that's taking place. But we want you to know that it's not a job fair. You're going to come here to learn the actual steps and the process to become an apprentice, to become a journeyman, and have a career in the building trades, a very fruitful, very rewarding career in the building trades. When you look around this city, from university to Green Street, just everywhere you go, all up and down university, all up and down Green Street, all over the city, you see building construction projects taking place. We need to be a part of that. There will be perpetual development as long as this country exists. The roads have to be maintained, the buildings have to be maintained, or they need to be torn down and rebuilt. We need to be a part of that process African American representation in the building trades needs to increase. We're working on that. This is the step towards that. So come to this event at the Douglas Center. We're going to be in the library meeting room, 1:30 to 4:30, July 29th. Spread the word. You don't have to bring a resume. All you have to do is come show up and learn how this process works. We will highlight and give to you the next steps from there. You just have to show up, be in the space, and give your, and now what you will have the opportunity to do is to talk face to face with the individuals who are the presidents, they are the presidents of these different organizations. They are the the business agents for these particular unions. You'll get an opportunity to shake their hands, look them in the eye, let them know what you're trying to do, find out which trade interests you, and then take the next steps to get that done. Partnering with the State Representative Carol Ammon's office to get this done. We're talking about follow-ups on how to teach and work on math, all those types of things to help strengthen your opportunities and likelihood of being an apprentice. Go ahead, Carla, you're on the air.
Hey, Aaron, it's Sandra. Hey, just Sandra. Wanted you to clarify, do they need to be there for the entire duration of that 1:30 to 4:30, or how long would you expect them to be there?
You are so wonderful with your questions. I sure do appreciate it. You do not have to be there for the entire time. We're trying to structure it, Sandra, in such a way that it won't just be one presentation. Hopefully we can structure it so that there's like two or three presentations. So if a person does have to leave and they can't stay the whole time, they'll get all the information. So we're working on that. But no, you do not have to be there the entire time.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
So this is a big step for us in the community. We've really been working hard on this. Many of you may know a painter, you may know an electrician, a carpenter or something like that. But as you look around the community, you don't see, we don't see enough of that, especially in the African-American community. We've talked a lot about this, what appears to be a battle between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, a couple of our great scholars or leaders, African-American leaders of the past. But in reality, so the argument is that W.E.B. Du Bois wanted more scholarship and the talented 10th, so to speak, and more educated African-Americans. And Booker T. Washington said, hey, you need to know how to work. You need to have to build stuff like they did at Tuskegee University, where Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver were both leaders in that school and helped develop the curriculum and all that type of stuff and build buildings there at Tuskegee University. Well, what we need is both. And so a lot of African Americans, and there was a lot of conversation around the African American community being upset with the school systems around the country for quote unquote tracking our children, for sort of pushing them towards careers in the trades or careers in the workforce and steering them away from college opportunities. And so then there was this big push to make sure that all the children were being steered and educated so that they were prepared for college. But all of you out there listening know that not everyone's going to college. Not all of our children are going to make it that route. And even some who go to college don't get jobs in the fields in which they thought they were going to get them in. So the building trades is a very viable option, a career choice for individuals. So we need to be introducing our children to the vocational trades and we're doing a little bit more of that now in the public schools different programs now that are being implemented at Centennial and at Central, trying to work with Parkland. I did get an email from a gentleman by the name of Mark Shagnon talking about how there's going to be 27 youth who are juniors and seniors who will free of charge be bused to Parkland College to learn about six different industries over there, and the construction trades being one of them, so that they can be introduced to other opportunities. Not everyone is going to college. So we have to make sure we prepare our youth, our children of the future, for other career opportunities as well, whether it's entrepreneurship, career in the building trades, things like that. So, you know, barber's license, what beauticians, a lot of different things that are actual skilled trades. But this is the construction trades. And it's extremely important for us to adhere to that and to share that information, very clear information to people about what's taking place. So I'm really, really urging you guys to help spread the word. In particular, this is for the minority. Quote, you know, y'all know I can't stand to use this term minority. Because if I'm minor, then I guess that means you're major. So I don't like it. But this is the terminology that we're using at this particular point. So, but we know that the construction trades, especially locally, and really all across the country, is it lacks the diversity that it needs to represent the populations and the geographic population in which most of them are located. So this is we applaud and appreciate the work that the building trades are doing as they come to the table to address some of these concerns and create these opportunities, because everyone knows that, you know, lack of jobs and lack of opportunities like that lead to poverty, which leads to violence and broken families and all that type of stuff. So if you're serious about wanting some change in your community, you're sick of all the violence, the senseless violence like we talked about earlier, why we have to have a Teron Jackson Memorial Fund, if you're sick of all of that type of stuff, then certainly in the African American community, we need access to, and we need a team of individuals who are ready to step up and fill these positions. So we're not talking about just giving a job to someone. You need to come and be prepared to earn this opportunity down here on July 29th. At the Douglas Center from 1:30 to 4:30 is the actual event. But we'd like you to get there at 1 p.m. so you can register. We can make sure we have the correct contact information for you, and we can follow up with you when it's time. So I really can't harp on this enough, because we got to keep going. And in walks, for more information, you should call me, Alderman Aaron Ammons, at 217-721-0934. For more information, you can call me, Alderman Aaron Ammons, at 721-0934. And you can also contact Representative Carol Ammons' office at 217-531-1660. Again, that's 217-531-1660. And as to channel my Reverend West, in walks my sidekick. Sister Carol, go ahead.
Good morning, Brother A-Dub. Good morning, listeners of WEFT and Higher Ground. I also wanted to add to that announcement that was just made for the Pathways to Apprenticeships. If you're listening and you have someone in the Chicagoland area, there will also be the same presentations will be done in the Chicagoland area on the south side and the west side. You can go on July 20th, which is coming up, July 20th. You can go to the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus website and find a location in Chicago. So if you have family that's in Chicago who also would like to be involved in this and learn how to get into the trade of their choice, on July 20th, the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus will be hosting several of the events as well. I believe there are three in the Chicagoland area starting on the 20th. And you can go to the Black Caucus website, just look up Illinois Legislative Black Caucus, and you can find the locations also in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make that quick announcement on this topic.
If they are in the Chicagoland area.
Yes, if you're in the Chicagoland area, you can go to the Chicago.
All right, so State Representative, it is nice to see you again. It's always good to have you down here on my show. Well, my show is my show. It's my show. So what did you want to come down here and talk to the people about this morning?
Well, I wanted to I know you have several important topics coming up on the traffic stop data for Urbana. And I wanted to talk to people about that. He's playing music behind me. He's so excited. He's starting music.
It was a mistake.
But I also wanted to let people know that, of course, we're still in the budget impasse, and kind of share a little bit about what is at question about the impasse. I don't know what I got a little squeakiness in my voice this morning. I was trying to get a smoothie, but I didn't have time to make it. So at any rate, we have a serious budget impasse going on, and wanted people to know what this impasse truly is about. The governor's office wants us to cut extremely essential services out of the state budget in order to get to that revenue number that he projected would be needed for the state back in February. So there's a lot of conversation going on about the General Assembly passing an unconstitutional, unbalanced budget. Just for the fact, the governor's budget that he introduced in February was a little bit more than $2 billion over the expected revenue. And the General Assembly's number was just under $4 billion over expected revenue. There hasn't been any conversation, however, about revenue at all at this point. And so I wanted people to know that what is that big gap between the governor and the Democratic representatives of the House? That big gap is child care resources, senior services, meal on wheels, changing the Medicaid eligibility requirements, changing what's called the determination of need score for senior services, and literally cutting 10 to 20,000 seniors out of the program. They've already administratively changed the child care resource eligibility requirements, and there's still some question about their ability to do that. But as a result of that, that change has already denied 2,000 people in Champaign, Urbana access to child care services already just from that administrative change. And some 29 to 30 other programs in the state will be permanently eliminated or closed. Rantoul has already closed its doors at Lincoln's Challenge as a result of this impasse. So what we're being asked to do, along with other significant changes to workers' rights through the collective bargaining process, he wants us to give him those concessions in order to get the revenue necessary to protect the most vulnerable in the state. And that's what the impasse is actually about. And so I wanted to come down in case...
I wanted to ask you a question about that.
You can. And if others want to, I guess you can give the number.
The representative is on with us this morning, y'all. Sister Carol is here. You can give us a call at 217-359-5483 if you want to ask her a question directly or make a comment, to her. You can call 217-359-5483. And of course, you have the panels that are set up at your office all week long. Just go to the website and you can see what time those panels are up.
StateRepCarolAmmons.com.
StateRepCarolAmmons.com. And you can see when those panels are set up where you can come and actually contribute to and help Carol maybe craft a bill or to read through some bills and say, hey, this is a good one and this is a bad one. I'd like for you to support this one or not support that one. Whatever the case may be, you can come and have your voice heard and partake in that. So one of the things that I was thinking about as you were reading the information is that there's so many different programs involved in that. Typically, why does this governor feel that collective bargaining rights and workers' compensation, how are those things tied to the budget of the state? Why does he feel like those are leveraging points in a negotiation?
Well, they won't have an impact directly on the budget at this point. Workers' compensation reform, which the General Assembly did workers' compensation reform between 2011 and 2015. They changed several things in the workers' compensation area. It doesn't have a direct impact on the budget. It has an impact on the business community. And so the governor's position, his position is if we make even more changes that he wants, which some of them are pretty drastic for injured workers. But if we make more changes to workers' compensation, it'll make Illinois what he considers a more business-friendly climate, and they will then generate more tax revenue if the businesses come here, and they'll be able to hire people and so on and so forth. So that's what he's put out as his logic. He's just simply using that as a means to get the General Assembly, specifically the Democratic members of the House, to give him significant changes, again, to workers' compensation in order for him to release the budget. In essence, he's basically holding all of these people in the state hostage for him to get these business changes he wants.
For under, his friends.
Under workers' compensation and for himself. Mm-hmm. Workers' compensation, tort reform are two of his major pieces. He just released a
that will help his businesses and stuff.
Will help what he consider will help businesses. Mm-hmm. Now it's not worker friendly, but certainly is business friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the of course the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate said, we're willing to talk to you about some other changes that you may want to see in workers' compensation, but we won't gut workers' compensation. Right, the protections that are there. That remain at this point are even, you know, significantly different than what it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll talk about this thing, right? But we can't hold this budget and all of these programs and all these people hostage as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. All right. We've got a caller here. Let's see what we got.
I couldn't find my headphone.
Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a quick question to the state representative. Does the governor have any agreements with any companies that are supposed to come to Illinois if we change our workers' compensation law?
Okay, so the
up and listen to your answer.
No, hold on just for a second there. I want to make sure we get this. She's getting her headphones together. Okay, I guess they hung up there. She act like she ain't never been down here before. I'm just going to bust out. Ain't no wrong with that. Can you hear now?
Okay.
All right. So the caller said, does the governor, do you know of any relationships or agreements that the governor has with other businesses that would come to Illinois if these reforms or if this stuff was implemented?
Unfortunately not. We've not gotten a list of anything from the governor in relationship to the policies that he wants. So even when we had a panel,
this question, do you know of any agreements that he has with other businesses that would come to Illinois
as a result of these
A result of these changes?
No.
Okay. So, Carl, I don't know if that's enough of an answer for you, but no. So,
I mean,
if you want to call back and elaborate, please feel free to do so. So, as with what I'm hearing, and I'm a little biased because I like you, you know, I hear. What I see when I watch this is that there's a guy who's a billionaire who, you know, I won't say he bought the election because Quinn did some things that ticked some people off. But he took it. He certainly used his money to help push through that and buying some folks in the Chicago area and preachers and promising them air conditioners and all that kind of different stuff so that they would get their congregations to either stay at home or come vote for him. There's a lot of little tactics that he used to, he spent his money. And certainly he has gone to the Republicans in the House and in the Senate and said, hey, listen, in the House in particular, I know, and said, hey, you do what I tell you to do, I'll give you money. Right. You know what I mean? And if you don't do what I do, tell you to do, I'll spend money to get you to run somebody against you, basically. Right. And he's very open about that. So you said the Republicans are following him step by step. Yes. Whatever he tells them to do, vote present. They vote present. He tell them to vote yes. They vote yes. That's what's happening right now in the House around this issue.
Happening in the House.
So what I hear is a billionaire saying, look, I'm finna look out for my billionaire buddies and other all them folks, and we're going to get these changes so we can continue to be a venture capitalist and keep getting rich off of your money. Go ahead, Carla. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm back. It's Paul. Appreciated your town meeting with Scott Bennett, and I'm going to throw this one out here again. It's a little touchy, I guess, but tensions are high. But what I brought up then and what I really think is the case is that Rauner is, you know, ridiculous. We're not going to get anywhere pressuring Rauner.
Nope.
And that means that the Democrats have to come up with a veto-proof budget.
You're right.
And I guess Wednesday, when both the House and the Senate were in session, I heard the coverage. I haven't followed it as closely as maybe I should for pontificating on this, but the coverage on the TV is so superficial that you can't really find anything anyway. But our head in the House, don't say his name, said he would not call the budget bills, the four that got the veto-proof majority in the Senate, he would not call them for the House. And there was no follow-up. I don't know if he took a question on why. Is it because he wants Rauner to be the fall guy for draconian cuts that he'd like to make anyway? Does he not have the votes to do it? Do we not have... So that's basically okay. Where I'm at. Rauner is useless, and I drew the analogy to the wahoo that's going on in Maine right now. This governor is just a total... he's worse than Rauner in some of his quotes. But
let me clarify for you.
Okay.
And please. I'll read it as a quote. Let me see here. If the House doesn't act today on, and this was Wednesday when we were there, if the House doesn't act today on Governor Rauner's appropriation vetoes, the bills all die. While the Senate may go ahead and override some vetoes today, the House doesn't appear likely to follow suit. The reason is Representative Jack Franks, Democrat from Marengo?
Marengo, anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Franks voted against all of the appropriation bills in May. He pretty much always votes against budgets, so that was no surprise. Franks did, however, vote for the bill which funded some essential services, state services and employee salaries for the 1 month, leading up to a widespread speculation that he might vote for the override. No luck. Quote, I firmly believe that we should not spend more than we have in revenue, Representative Franks told me last night. Therefore, I will not be voting to override the vetoes. That's our one vote that we need to have 71 to override the vetoes.
Okay, where is the source on that, just to be dot the I's?
This comes from Capital Facts.
Capital Facts, yeah. He's a pretty good guy.
Yeah.
The other thing I brought up is the idea of revenues, and why isn't the idea of a tax swap being discussed? I've been arguing with this with people, some on Facebook and other places. The way I remember it, and this is Illinois history, and Edgar ran against Don Clark Netsch, who was offering the tax swap idea, that is, reducing property tax by increasing income tax a little bit, and I think that's what we need. I think we need to go to 6.5 and devote 1% of the increase to tax reduction for property tax and target it by limiting the amount that any one person can collect on their house so that a McMansion guy doesn't get, you know, a windfall, and a person who's living in a modest house like me doesn't, get any commensurate. So that would be a way of making it sort of progressive in a backwards way.
Maybe you can work with us in one of our panels. We have a government panel to get the framework to draft that bill so we can submit it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Paul.
I'd like to do that. I just wonder whether, sometimes it just seems fruitless, though, if we've got people like this guy. And I think, I don't know how many unions there are and other like-minded people in his district, but I think they need to put the pressure on that one guy if that's it, if that's really the pivot, that's for sure.
Okay.
It seems to me. But this idea, Illinois history I wanted to cover, and I'll sign off with this because I got to start work on my show in an hour. I got some fresh Stephen Silita interview, by the way.
Okay, Paul, I got to get this other call coming. Well, they hung up now.
Okay, all right. I'll mention what I was going to mention on the beginning of my show.
So okay, all right, thanks.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
So the other caller, now he hung up. Okay, so call back, caller, if you were on 359-5483 or 359-6545. So we're just sort of wrapping up here. I do think that there is a legitimate issue for my that when I hear that Rauner, right, I do think that when you see something like that, what I'm hearing is that there's a battle that's taking place here.
There is a
right
battle.
And certainly politics are at play,
absolutely.
At the end of the day, I just think there needs to be almost like a refresher or a course from where you know, as a mentor used to say, let's go back, right? Let's go back. Because at the end of the day, what you have is a, for whatever reason, a Democratic majority in both houses, right? Which means that the sort of mindset of philosophy of the Democrats is what's sort of driving state government, supposed to be, right? But what you have, what in reality is that you have people who have particular titles, but their ideology or their actual votes don't always line up with those things, because there's just certain nuances and things that are going on there. It's not as cut and dry as you see from a distance. So for me, what I see is a big push from a guy who wants to says he's going to shake up Springfield, but he really wants opportunities to create more money for businesses. It's the old and Alec, of course, he's pushing the agenda of the American Legislative Exchange Commission. So we have to talk about those things. And it just needs more time, really, I think, to sort of break those things down. And unfortunately, Carol's Corner only has like 2 minutes and 30 seconds left before I have to move on.
So I lost all of my time. Thanks, Paul. So what I would like to just highlight is what he does bring up, Paul brought up, is that we have a member that people need to be calling his office and pressuring him, because as a result of that, if we allow these cuts to go through and remain where they are, right, people are not going to have the assistance that they need. Point blank, they will lose home care services. They are losing them. They will lose child care services, and they are losing them and being denied coverage. The change that they made, this is so significant, I want to read it exactly the way it is. Mm-hmm. The biggest change to the IDHS, the Illinois Department of Human Services, Child Care Assistance Program, which, by the way, is 75% funded from the federal government. So we get a lot of money from the federal government to run this program. The changes that are made is approximately 90% of new applicants who would otherwise meet the income requirement threshold and work and continue to work, they will be denied child care. So if you're a student going to school, you'll be denied child care. If you work $8.25 an hour job or more, $8.50, you're denied child care, because they lowered the income eligibility threshold, not at 130%, they lowered it down to 50%. So almost 90% of the people don't qualify for services. Mm-hmm. Where they would normally qualify according to the federal guidelines, now they don't qualify, mm-hmm. which is a significant impact and change in the state.
So do we think that, you know, this sort of reminds me of a situation in Urbana, actually, where our township supervisor said, hey, listen, there are way too many people on these roles. Something, the checks and balances aren't really there where they should be. All of these people don't actually qualify, right? So we need to go back and go through here and have people reapply and make sure that they have the qualifications that they're supposed to have. I guess what I'm getting at is that it's a possibility that there needs to be some sort of reform or something there to make sure that people are not taking advantage of the system. But what you're describing is just a draconian cut type of look. You're not talking about, hey, we found 10% or 15% of the people who shouldn't be on here taking advantage of it. You're saying let's cut from whatever. How much are they cutting it from? What's the percentage?
90%.
Cutting it. I mean, come on now.
90% of new applicants won't qualify.
That's just, I don't care about the people. That's what that says to me.
And I would just say, just for the record, on the township, there was a change.
Okay, no, you can't get into township stuff
there was
because
a
your
change,
time is up,
though,
up and you're not
township.
On the Urbana City Council anymore, so you can't talk about those things. So listen, but I want to thank you for calling, because I have a clip that I want to play in preparation. Thank you for coming in, because mm-hmm. I have a clip that I'd like to play in preparation for my next guests that are coming up.
Okay.
So if there's something just absolutely pressing that you wanted to share right now, I will afford you that opportunity.
I can filibuster. I do want to encourage people to come on the 29th at the Douglas Library. We're trying to do what we can to help get people into employment, real living wage employment, because mm-hmm. that's significant living wage. And we also want you to just call our office. If you want to find out other things that we're doing, you can visit our website. Website is staterepcarolammons.com. pretty easy. StateRepCarolEmmons.com, or come visit me at 407 East University Avenue. If I'm not in session, I'm usually in the office there or meeting or somewhere, but they can get me. You can call at 217-531-1660.
How's your workout going?
Pretty good. It's pretty hot out there today, though.
Good. All right, y'all. So thank you, State Representative Sister Carol, for coming down here and hanging out with us. And we'll be back on with you next time. Thank you very much.
Listen, I want
you all to stay tuned because my next guest coming up, we're going to be talking about the IDOT traffic stop data and the work that the task force has been doing in the city of Urbana around this. But one of the things that I have been talking about for years is the ending of this and the need to end this so-called war on drugs, which has only been a war on black, brown, and poor white folks. And so I want to play a clip from one of the members of law enforcement against prohibition. This is ex-prosecutor James Gehrig from Cook County. Please listen well to what he has to say.
We share the same belief in common. It is time, long past time, to end the drug war. Joining us this portion of our program with a LEAP member is James Gehrig, a former prosecutor as assistant state's attorney of Cook County, Illinois. Among many other credits to his name, one newspaper called him Illinois' premier conscientious objector to the war on drugs. Thank you so much for joining us, Jim.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now, you've said that, quote, the war on drugs puts more drugs everywhere and is at the heart of most American crises.
Correct.
And now you've spent 20 years fighting drug prohibition because of it. So talk to us about why this has been the thrust of your work, and then we'll get to some of the extraordinary work you've done with the UN, with President Barack Obama, and what you're doing internationally.
Well, I was part of the war on drugs in the early 70s. At the time, the best heroin in Chicago and across the United States was 2% pure. After 40 years of drug war, Nixon declaring the war on drugs in 1971, we now have 90% pure heroin everywhere. Prohibition, because of the economics of prohibition, causes something that grows on a plant to become the most valuable commodity on the face of the earth. So people are breaking their neck trying to figure out how to get the drugs in order to earn the exorbitant, artificially inflated prohibition prices, where there's unlimited money that can be made. And because of that, we have more drugs because of the war on drugs instead of less. And then because the kids, at least in Chicago and many places across the country, want to earn that money, they're quitting school, joining a gang, getting a gun, shooting each other, fighting over who's going to control corner drug sales. One corner can be worth $30,000 a day in sales.
Wow.
We catch some of the kids. So what do we do when we catch somebody who shoots somebody else? Well, we have to put them in jail. So we build prisons to the point where we can't pay for schools. Here in Chicago, we have humongous debt problems like many places in the nation. And so we're closing schools but opening prisons. During the 1990s, because of the war on drugs, our prison population went from 300,000 to 2.3 million people, so that the land of the free has become the prison capital of the world, with the highest rate of incarceration anywhere in the world. The world has 10 million people locked up behind bars, and 25% of those prisoners are accounted for by the United States.
And yet, when we look at that, of course, as I said earlier, and as you know from the facts, that 50% of them are in for nonviolent offenses, generally drug possession or drug use.
Correct. Prohibition came once before, and Al Capone enjoyed it for some 13 years before the people said, we've had enough of this prohibition. It's causing so many horrible problems, violence and corruption. The undermining of government, disrespect for law enforcement, the police pouring out these barrels of beer and laughing, and the people in political power buying up the stores of liquor when they saw prohibition coming so they didn't run out during the dry spell. And then we forget the lesson that society learns, and we decide, well, we're going to save our kids from drugs. Drugs are bad, can destroy lives. Drugs are addicting. Drugs can be harmful. So what do we do? Well, common sense tells us, let's outlaw them, let's prohibit them, let's save the kids from the drugs. And we learned how to just say no. We learned the value of zero tolerance. And the consequence of that intolerance was a rebirth of prohibition, putting more drugs everywhere, corrupting the kids, corrupting the police, having people overdosing on substances because they don't know what the heck it is they're consuming, because when you outlaw something, you give up the right to control and regulate it. So even though you buy your drug from the same corner, the same dealer that you do each week, the guy who's selling it doesn't know what's in it. Because when you outlaw something, you can't control and regulate it. You can't tell the drug gangs, listen, you guys can't sell this stuff. We're going to put you in jail if you sell it. But if you're going to sell it anyway and run the risk in order to earn the money, put a label on it. Regulate the purity of it. Put an advertisement on the thing, a label like we do other things. Like, you can only put so much alcohol in a beer because it's regulated. You can only put so much hard liquor in the scotch bottle because the government regulates it. But we have delegated the control of drugs in America to the discreet gangs and the drug cartels, who decide what drugs will be sold, how strong they are, what they're going to be cut with, how old you have to be to buy it, i.e. no age. When can you buy it? 24 hours a day. Who can you buy it from? They decide those things.
And you've also pointed out that there's a big difference now between, as you pointed out, the natural drugs and now the synthetic drugs, and that prohibition has driven this increase of more and more dangerous man-made substances, again, because there's no regulation. So we've gone from natural substances being used, which have been on the planet for millennium, to synthetic drugs that are completely new and manufactured by these cartels.
You're absolutely correct. I have learned that the United Nations is really responsible for the global war on drugs because they passed the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs that says that the only use of drugs that is lawful is a medical purpose or a scientific purpose. Well, many people use drugs for a recreational purpose. And this 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs that 186 nations signed up to agree with provides for the criminalization and incarceration of any person who violates the terms of the treaty. The treaty says that you can only use it for medical or a scientific purpose. Well, in Schedule 1 of that treaty is heroin, and next to it is marijuana. How foolish.
It's outrageous.
Horrendously different in danger and harm to people. One is really a medicine, and Schedule 1, according to the United Nations, is a schedule for a substance that's potentially very addictive and harmful and has no medicinal value. And yet across the United States, the people are voting in referendum after referendum to put in place medical marijuana. Half the states where that's happened has been by action of the state legislature. So the treaties are an abomination. And when I went the first time to the Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna, and I learned that there were 119 bad drugs on the yellow list, and they were the customary drugs, the heroin, the cocaine, the things that grow on the plant you're speaking of. But the first year I went in 2012, I learned that there were 43 new synthetic drugs invented that year. The next year I go back in March, the next year each March, and they report 50-some new synthetic drugs were invented by the cartels. The next year I go back, it was 100 new synthetic drugs invented. And this March, 2015, when I leave Vienna, they report that there's over 300 new synthetic drugs invented by the drug cartels in the past year, making the problem and the invention of harm exponentially worse.
No. So, I had a question that I mentioned earlier, I'm sorry, to Rafer Davis, but I think you're really the appropriate person of the four we're talking to tonight, given your international travels and your work with the UN, is my observation that the cartels that have been the drug runners are also the weapons traders and now involved in the most heinous of the cartel industry, which is human enslavement. And that I find just absolutely repugnant, that our society is still hung up on somebody smoking a joint, but they could care less about, you know, the millions of people who go missing every day.
The war on drugs has warped the policing mission in America and the world. It used to be that police were there to protect people from one another, to catch people who did bad things. And instead, we decided to save our kids from drugs, outlawed substances, and outlawed adult behavior between consenting adults. So somebody who's a willing buyer from a willing seller has been made a criminal. And why do we do that? Well, because when we do that, we now have a prison industry that's mushrooming. Things are going gung-ho with subcontractors and contractors making money hand over foot. Reportedly, the fastest-growing housing in the United States during the 1990s is prisons. We have people getting more money in drug testing. The drug testing concession in Cook County is worth 20-some million dollars. So if you're in the drug testing business, are you in favor of the war on drugs? Sure. When we have a successful drug bust, we confiscate three things: drugs, cash, and guns. Who gets the money? Half goes to the law enforcement agency, the local one that was involved in the bust, and half goes to the feds. So if you're running a local police department like the one a few miles from where I'm sitting, and they put up a new Taj Mahal police department in an area where we have virtually no crime, and how much did they pay for this multi-million-dollar police department? Nothing. How much in taxes? Nothing. How much in bonded indebtedness? Nothing. Where did the money come from? We hijacked the drug dealer's money, and we're using it. We're buying squad cars. We're putting up buildings. We're paying $100 million a year in overtime to Chicago police, who bust somebody for marijuana at the end of their shift. Now they work 2 hours of overtime. Now they have to go to court. By the time the young kid gets to court for his marijuana possession on Monday, we spent 3 days of prison time over a weekend. So now we got a $43 million bill to the Cook County Board that they can't afford because we got 10,000 people locked up in the Cook County Jail. It's the money that's kept the drug war going, even though the common man everywhere knows that the war on drugs is a failure, causes what it's intended to prevent, and is the heart of nearly any crisis you can name in America. The problem of guns, gangs, crime, prisons, taxes, AIDS, overdose, corruption of the police, corruption of the kids, no money for schools, job programs, the funding of terrorism, the racially discriminatory impact of policing, the use of excess force, the militarization of the police department. What's wrong with America and the world is the war on drugs.
So I want to thank you all for being patient and tuning in and listening to Mr. James or Jim Gehrig of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. All you have to do is Google or to go to YouTube and look for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition 2015. I have been listening to these videos and talking to these individuals like Neil Franklin, who we brought in town, for many, many years, trying to share with our community the importance of ending this so-called war on drugs. You're listening to a prosecutor out of the city of Chicago who's been doing this for decades break down how this has impacted almost every facet of our society. And as we here in Champaign begin to deal with the violence that's sweeping our streets because these young people are chasing a life of drugs because of the money that they can possibly make. And then there are robberies associated with that. And then there's territorial beefs associated with that. And then there's innocent people getting shot down and killed on the streets all the time now in a city where we hardly ever heard of these things. This is the drug war coming to a place near you, and it's going to affect you. Now we're going to talk about how it has impacted the policing and how it's racialized the stops in the policing. It affects almost every facet of our life. If you're concerned about the violence on your street, the incarceration of your youth, and the incarceration of black, brown, and poor white people, and locking them out of job opportunities, then you need to stay tuned, and you need to make sure you go look up LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. My guest this morning, Mr. Durrell Cruz, who is our local expert on traffic stops, Mr. Chris Evans, who is our walking encyclopedia historian of all kind of different stuff. And and Martell should be on his way down here soon. And of course, the state rep is still in the house because she's still an organizer. She's still an activist. She just happens to be an elected official as well. So, gentlemen, welcome to Higher Ground. Cool. Go ahead, talk to the people, y'all.
Thanks,
so you
gotta
go right into those microphones, y'all. Okay. Put them up to you.
Good morning, and thank you for having us here.
Yes, indeed.
Appreciate it.
It is an honor to be on the very radio station that John Lee Johnson started.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. All right, y'all. So we've got about an hour. Let's just go right into it. Daryl, I know that you have been working on this and talking about this for many, many years. You were shunned. You were not appointed to this task force, which I still vehemently disagree with, because your attendance is probably as well or better than half of the people who are on the task force. But that's just me taking my shot. Let's just get down to the brass tacks of what it is. What is it that you want to share with the people today?
Well, there's an awful lot to talk about. And I would just suggest, first of all, that if you were interested in issue of traffic stop disparities, that you can go to the Urbana City website and click on government and click on boards and commissions, and you will see the Urbana IDOT Traffic Task Force. If you click on that, you can go and find the Urbana Traffic Stop Report. And I would encourage people who are interested to go to the city website and take a look at that information and read that report to begin with. I think it's important to remember that this task force was established because it has been documented that, in fact, there are racial disparities with regards to traffic stops in Urbana. As a matter of fact, it's not just Urbana. It's consistent throughout East Central Illinois. It's very similar between communities like Urbana and Champaign and Decatur and Danville. There's not anything unique happening in Urbana that isn't happening in these other communities.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not picking on Urbana per se. I think there's just a group of people that are interested in those disparities and trying to understand what the implication of racial disparities has in our community in terms of policing relationships, in terms of impact on communities of color, and also if, in fact, it's accomplishing its intended purposes, and that is reducing crime and making our community safer. And those are very real questions that need to be addressed as part of this discussion. And so, excuse me, that's a little bit of the background of, I think, why the city of Urbana established the task force and has spent a year now studying it in a number of ways. There are four components to the report. There's basically a research component in which Eric Jacobson gathered scholarly research regarding racial disparities in traffic stops. There's an impact study that has been done to look at, you know, what is the psychological, financial, social sort of impact of these disparities. There's a statistical component that has compiled the data with regards to the information available regarding traffic stops. And then there's kind of policing and community engagement. How can we improve relations with the community and the police department, and what types of things are being done to make that happen also? So those are basically the four parts of the task force's report, draft report.
So Martell Miller is here with us also. So Martell, what would you like to share with the people about the this commission and what they have found?
I'm just going to share some of the history of how I got involved with traffic. And mine's come from me and Patrick dealing with young youths, and they was talking about we was trying to start a mentor program. And the first thing the youths kept telling us, we don't need help with school. We need help with the police at this time. And from that, we started talking to youths and watching the interaction with the police. Then we decided we wanted to monitor the police. And this was like 2004. Then we started noticing the different types of traffic stops and how people was getting pulled over and From that, that's when I really realized that it was something really going on with young African-American getting stopped. I knew it when I was growing up that we worried about the police stopping us, but it wasn't at the rate of getting stopped and getting ticketed and getting from a traffic stop. We're going to resisting arrest and other things where it's they weren't just getting a ticket, they were going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And and so it's still going on today. And Mandura have been dealing with that probably since, I say about 2006, Daryl.
Yep, at least.
So, Chris, I wanted you to add something to this as well. We're just trying to give people an idea as they're listening what they're going to hear from you all. So from your perspective, what did you want to share about this?
Well, I guess I wanted to say that here's a situation where we've studied it. We've got it kind of, people are not crazy. Mm-hmm. The police seem to have a bias, and it's not good for the police, it's not good for the community, and it's not good to have unequal application of the law, and that's mm-hmm. what we're really talking about in Champaign County. So I'm hoping that by experts like Daryl Cruz here shedding light on what this data is and what it tells us, that we could out of that talk to aldermen like yourself to get policy changes better to improve the community.
And it sounded like there may be some of that I'm hearing under the policing community engagement. The police officer, Sergeant Charles, who was on the task force, talked about some possible changes in policing or those types of things. I thought I heard some of that from him. Talk to us about this.
I think we need to back up just one step.
Okay.
And that is, when we talk about traffic stops, generally the public has a vision of what that entails. And most people think of traffic stop in terms of the experiences that they've had or have been expressed to them by their friends. And for most people, that experience involves a violation of the motor vehicle code, which is simply a traffic stop for running a stop sign, speeding, which is characterized as a safety traffic stop. Mm-hmm. It's basically to make sure our streets are safe. And sometimes it's pretty hard to wrap your head around when we use the term traffic stop that it does not just describe that type of stop, that there are other types of stops that are occurring that are also within that broader term of traffic stop that most people don't experience or aren't aware of. And so it's difficult when you talk about racial disparities and the impact of that to understand, well, how can that be or what's going on there? And I would suggest that when you look at the data, and what I found most revealing in the last year is the Urbana Police Department, in this case, Sergeant Charles, was very good at describing how the Urbana Police Department uses traffic stops for a variety of policing purposes other than traffic safety. And the first time I heard that, I said, oh, wow, this is interesting. What does this mean? It's not a big secret within the police departments. Matter of fact, it's a very common practice, and it's one that's part of their training. It's part of what it is that they've come to believe is a way of fighting crime and making the community safe. And there is current data after 20 or 30 years that is beginning to show that that is questionable, which we can get to at some point in time. But this stop is called a pretextual stop. In other words, a vehicle traffic code is used to legally stop a car, but the purpose of that stop is used as a pretext to question or investigate something about the driver or the occupants of the drivers beyond the traffic stop itself. And that falls into an area called the investigatory traffic stop.
All right, I want you to pin it right there, because I think you've laid the framework for me to move around the room a little bit, because Martell and I know firsthand, we have been experiencing these pretextual stops for decades in the black community, And I'm tying it to a video that I listened to not too long ago, listened to one of the LEAP officers talking about how they pulled over this kid. And this happened to be, I forgot which city it was, but he was on a moped. And they pulled this kid over because they thought he looked suspicious. They thought he was doing a drug deal, right? So they pulled him over for some, he didn't use his signal far enough from the stop sign or whatever. They pull him over. They go through his whole moped. They don't find anything. And it's four or five big old guys saying, hey, can I search your moped? And of course he consents. They rip it apart. They don't find anything. And they send him on his way. And he said it started to dawn on him that they looked like the bullies, the gang or whoever who was looking for whatever. And they just planted a horrible seed of the police department in this kid's mind, because this kid knew that he had, you know, this was not a big deal. I didn't signal far enough away from the stop or whatever. They didn't find nothing. And it just really created a social tension between the police department and this young kid. And so, Martell, I wanted you to sort of build on that and tie that to your previous comments.
Okay. I'm going to go with something like what happened to him. But this happened a few years back to me. I got stopped. And the officer said, my car looks suspicious. I said, looks suspicious. So I agreed with him. I said, it does look suspicious. And I ran away from him, got by him. And I said, yeah, what am I supposed to do about the suspicious car? Then he said, are you being sarcastic? Mm-hmm. I said, no, you told me it looks suspicious. So I looked at it and it looked suspicious too. So I'm trying to see what we going to do about this. And the officer got totally mad about me. But he gave me the out when he said my car looks suspicious. And from that let me know that an officer can stop you on any pretense, not even nothing doing with the law. But the more I've been around dealing with the law, learning about the law, he actually was stopping my freedom to move because he had no reason to stop me. And that's how I wish we could deal with some of these traffic stops, because you have freedom of movement through this United States as long as you're not breaking any law. So they are breaking the law to make the law. And my thing is, how do we deal with that? You know?
Go ahead, Daryl. Yeah, Chris, I'll let you come in after that.
I'm going to say, first of all, the police are not breaking the law when they conduct these pretextual traffic stops. That is supported by a Supreme Court decision, but it's a very controversial one, and it's accepted by law enforcement and society. And so,
is there a name to that one? Was it a case?
Well, it was. Yes. It was maybe 10, 15 years ago. It appeared before the Supreme Court. And so these pretextual stops, as questionable as they are in terms of their intent, are legal.
Are these the Terry stops? No. Okay. No. Different. Okay. These, go ahead.
Yeah. And so what occurs in terms of the experience of the engagement of the police officer and that driver becomes kind of the behind-the-scenes experience of the traffic stop that the great majority of our community never experiences or never sees. And as a result, the type of experience that Martell just shared is very difficult for a lot of people to wrap their heads around, because they're thinking, no, that's not going on. Or, and we can talk about this a little bit later, well, that's okay, because that's a way of fighting crime, which we could talk about, okay, whether in fact how we're fighting crime is effective, whether there's some racial bias. We could talk about the term profiling a little bit later, what the data says, and we can talk about the impact of that, especially when there's racial disparities that mean that that is occurring numerically greater than it should. For a certain group of people, that experience is experienced multifold more than it is for Caucasian drivers. And the impact is multifold greater in terms of police community relations, because it's so disproportionate that over a period of years, it's like everybody has had that experience to some degree within the color.
Let me tie this to this impact statement.
Yeah.
Because the kid is alone, you know. He has a bad seed planted on the moped, right? Martell has a bad seed planted on the moped. But when Toto Kayewu is killed, because see, he looked suspicious as an African American or African in this vehicle in What was it? What was the town that he was in? Villa Grove, or where it was. Remember, the initial thing was he looked suspicious, yeah. And so now he ends up dead, right? But this is a part of that conditioning, that with the Texas license plates or something like that, that he's possibly running drugs or something like that. And now he ends up dead. So now, see, the impact is far beyond just the individual. Now it's the family. Now it's the community. And when they, even though there's all this other stuff we talked about as what happened around that situation, the pretext, right, the reasoning is directly tied to what we were just talking about, the suspicion,
right?
You know, and on one hand, you get some, you know, your suspicion or your hunch leads to some bust. And then on some other hand, it leads to somebody being unlawfully or unnecessarily killed, you know, unnecessarily killed. Go ahead, Martell.
With my stop, he would got me. If he had said, I look suspicious, it'd have been different. He said, my car looks suspicious. Mm-hmm. So I'm really trying to figure out. The only thing that was on my car, I had tinted windows. And how many other cars you see with tinted windows? And that's what made my, after we went through the little dialogue, that's what he said, you got tinted windows on your car. And I said, so that's what made my car look suspicious? And this was after I did my little act with him, you know, trying to make him, try to tell him what was suspicious about the car. He didn't have nothing. And when we came to the end of it, it's that you had tinted windows. Now, how many other cars he could choose to stop with tinted windows?
Chris, what you got for me, man? Come on, jump on in here.
Well, I just wanted to remind Durrell and Martell of one of the things that the task force did was to hold a public forum at the Urbana Civic Center, and it allowed for a time on the microphone and video recorded to talk to the task force and some council members about their experiences with police department. And I think one of the things, the most under, you know, these stories are in the community pretty widespread. The one thing that really astonishes me, when you have thousands upon thousands, and I had this, I sent you the numbers earlier, and I didn't bring them today, but the number of thousands of tickets that are issued every year, and you've only got 26,000 African Americans to pick from. So after 10 to 15 years of this kind of pattern of behavior, everybody's in the system, everybody owes money, everybody is disqualified from a job if it led to something else. I have to wonder too, these experiences with the officers, their demeanor, the reason for the stop, you know, they're telling you one thing, but they're really stopping you for another. That, how does that feed into the resisting arrest charges, the disorderly conduct charges? Mm-hmm. And it's not good for the police reputation. Everybody gets hostile, and the last people you want to have an argument with are people carrying guns, mm-hmm. I would assume. And I want officers to be safe out there and do their job effectively. But if you've got this tendency and these habits, got to deal with it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think I heard you say earlier, Durrell, was that you're not picking on the city of Urbana. And I think that what you highlighted was that the consistency in traffic stop disparities all across the state, all across the country, the consistency in those disparities clarifies that we are not picking on Urbana or any other place, right? And so we're not anti-police, right? You know, that's not what's being discussed here. What we're actually doing out of appropriate due diligence and our obligations as citizens is that we're saying, listen, we are offering a critique, a grievance here, and we're saying, listen, how do we solve this? For me, I'm tying this back to the drug war. I'm saying that the police, like everybody else, has been socially conditioned to believe that African Americans, Latinos, and poor whites are the people that you have to target in particular for low-level drug offenses or to get drugs off the streets, right? And they've been conditioned in that way. Go ahead, Chris.
But do you, Alderman Ammons, have the political will to question your police chief that very
do
question?
Do I? Are you asking me?
Up to now, we have not had that kind of political representation.
Right.
And it's, you know, and your wife, as a city council member, got this task force launched and underway. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the solution has to be an insistence to the police department that we have to have a change. And where does that come from?
And I think the education is a part of it, too, that we're not your statement, Daryl, in relationship to Urbana feeling like it's being picked on. It's very similar when I have a conversation with a white person talking about race. They say, I'm not racist, because they feel like you're picking on them. And the city of Urbana, the police department, is responding in a very similar way, because you're talking about race. So I don't want us to get too – I know it's a lot of information here. I want to come back to you, Daryl, because, you know, you've been in this, yeah. And I want to keep it there as much as possible, and then we jump in from round to round. Go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate Chris's comment. But I think there's another level there also, and that is that I think the Urbana Police Department is doing what it chooses to do in terms of policing the Urbana community, because they are honestly feeling that they are using appropriate policing tactics to help reduce crime and make neighborhoods safe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I'm going to suggest that the data shows that maybe that's not true. Maybe there are better ways we should be policing communities and using traffic stops based upon the accumulation of our understanding now over the last couple of decades, and that police chiefs need to maybe reevaluate the current way that they look at policing certain communities in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me give you an example or two or three, and maybe the community people can call in, or, you know, Martel and
so
Chris
that's
can
a perfect
respond.
Thing. So you're listening to 90.1 FM when you're listening dial. This is Higher Ground, Brother A-Dub, your host, with Daryl Cruz, Chris Evans, and Martel Miller talking about the IDOT traffic stop data in the city of Urbana. If you want to call us, give us a call down here at 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545, and you can ask your question or make your statement on the air.
Yeah, a couple of quick things. I don't know if the public remembers, but about 2 months ago, the News Gazette on the front page, one of its reporters did a ride-along with the Urbana Police Department.
Hmm.
And in that front page story, they talked about a traffic stop that was made at about 9:03 in the evening. And the person was stopped because he did not have a light on over his license plate. His license plate was out.
Mm, that sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It was a young black man.
Mm-hmm.
And
just happened to be black.
And
though,
it's,
right?
this is in the paper. Okay, this is in the paper. The News Gazette is reporters talking to the officer. And he goes and talks to the car he stopped. And he didn't find anything wrong. And he didn't give a ticket. Okay, he just gave a warning. And he told the News Gazette reporter that he stopped the guy because he knew he had a history with marijuana.
He said it, right?
He said it, right there, okay? So, and most people say, oh, that's great policing. You, no, you're checking, you know, on the drug war issue. You're following people you know that have histories. And it's a perfect example of pretextual stop, and the question becomes, what's the impact of that that's repeated on people? So that's just an example. And when I asked Sergeant Charles about that incident, because I FOIA'd it to get more information and brought it to the attention of the task force, he said, well, that's kind of an outlier sort of traffic stop. He didn't think that that really occurred that frequently. And my guess is that it occurs more frequently than we want to admit, because the data says such. And let me give you an example. And I have to give credit to Paul Tessa, who's the statistician on the task force. And I have to give some credit to the Urbana Police Department for working with the task force. And I think they've done so very positively and willingly to help the task force accomplish what it's trying to do. And there was some information or data revealed through that process that did not come out in the IDOT traffic report, but it's internal data that the police department, that's totally fascinating. Okay, public should take a look at it. But one of them was the Urbana Police Department runs a program called STEP Once in a While. It's Selective Traffic Enforcement Program, and it's where you set up purposefully where there might be a high frequency of accidents or people speeding, or you have a neighborhood where residents are complaining of loud noise or something. And so to address these traffic issues, the Urbana Police Department will set up patrols for the purpose of monitoring traffic speeding. It's called STEP. And Urbana has the statistics of the breakout by race in terms of tickets and stops that are done. The racial disparities drop significantly, okay? African Americans only were stopped about 25% more than any other racial group, where in the regular traffic stop data, this past year, they are stopped 75% more frequently than you would expect. And in previous years, it's about twice as much as what you would expect. So when you're conducting stops based solely on traffic vehicular laws, the disparities basically dissipate or at least shrink significantly. Now, when you do traffic stops pretextually or in an investigatory way, you're adding a new dimension to that. And one of the things Paul Tessa did is he was able to link traffic stops to the types of charges, and they were able to go to the courthouse and get all of the types of tickets that were issued with regards to traffic stops. And they listed the top 10 charges by race for traffic stops, which says a great deal about what is going on as a result of traffic stops. I would ask Martel and Aaron if they could guess what they think maybe one or two of the top charges are for. I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you the charge.
Or the reason for the stop.
Well, not the reason. It's a charge. It's not necessarily because a stop can occur and sometimes there's multiple charges. Frequently, you get multiple charges.
Okay, so let me do this.
Okay.
Let's see if we can. And I'm tying mine through drug war stuff, right?
Okay.
All right. So
no,
the pretextual stop is because your license plate light was out. You have something dangling from your rearview mirror. You didn't signal 100 feet from wherever you were supposed to stop. Your music was too loud. Let's see. Now, those are my pretextual stuff.
Those are pretext.
Okay. Now, the charge is going to be resisting arrest, obstruction of justice. I guess if they find something, maybe it'll be a marijuana charge or something like that. Those are going to be my top two. No, what we got?
Okay.
Go ahead, Martel.
I will tell you my top two. Obstruction of justice.
Okay.
And resisting arrest. And because a lot of times at a traffic stops, after they didn't stop the person, and I go to start asking the officer a question, they get mad at me, and the first thing come out their mouth, I'm going to get you for obstructing the justice.
Okay.
And I haven't even committed a crime.
All right,
but
let's see where we at.
They threatened me with that charge.
Okay.
We put ourselves out there.
And that's good. Good. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Okay. That's all right.
But these are charges by race. And this and what this shows is the financial impact that people of color experience, and people of color, and especially people that might be poor, okay, when they encounter traffic stops. For whites, the number one reason was driving 15 to 20 mile an hour above the speed limit. They were given a ticket.
15 to 20 miles per hour.
That's 2,411 between 2004 and 14 were, and that fine is $108. Okay,
and
over
cost,
that time.
Over that time period, it cost whites $2,000.
No, there were 2,411 tickets written for speeding. That's the number one reason. You know, so you have white people, the number one experience is speeding, and you get a ticket that averages $108 over the last 10 years. Okay, for an African American, it's operating an uninsured motor vehicle. Now, I told you the number of tickets charges for speeding was 2,411. Mm-hmm. For operating an uninsured motor vehicle is 2,503. There are more charges for an uninsured motor vehicle on African Americans, even though they make up 16% of the driving public, than whites for speeding. Do you know what the mean ticket for an uninsured motor vehicle is?
At least
$186. That's $80 more per ticket that you're paying. Mm-hmm. The number two charge is driving on a suspended license. The number three, not having a license. Number eight, driving on a revoked license. Four of the top 10 reasons are directly related to what I would call many times the difficulty of poor people to maintain and insure their vehicles. And those charges are higher than the typical charges that you experience for driving over the speed limit or disregarding a stop sign.
Mm-hmm.
And so the impact of this, it showed that people of color generally pay higher charges and are directly fees, and it's directly related because of the financial means for them to maintain and insure cars, and it has a compounding effect in terms of then driving. So if you're part of stopping somebody, is you don't know if they're driving without insurance. The only thing you might know is on the license tag if the car's not licensed. So if you're stopped, these are generally secondary charges to the initial stop that are added. So there are multiple charges generally as an outcome of a traffic stop that doesn't necessarily occur for most white people or Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the investigatory experience that occurs, and we can talk about that also.
All right.
I'll just throw that out there.
Go ahead, Martell.
As of, I think, 2013, the insurance company are now supposed to keep update the cars that's insured to the day. That's something they passed through the state, I think about 2 years ago, where it shouldn't take them more than 24 hours once you make your payment to tie your payment to your license plate. And that's how they know, because I know a person that just got stopped, and they told them, we're stopping you because you ain't got no insurance. Yeah. And they tried to figure out why, and the officer told them, when I ran your license plate, it shows that you don't have any insurance. And they,
wow.
And they asked him for proof of insurance.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay,
Chris has got it here. I got another thing to add to that.
Well, I agree with everything that Durrell has said from the perspective of those that are ticketed, that yes, those are the type of infractions that would affect poor people the most. But the method of detection is what I want to get to. Okay. So there is no way that you can look at traffic as it goes by you and say, oh, that person's got a suspended license. Oh, that person's driving on a revoked license. Oh, that person's got no insurance. You can't do that. And the
except for the license plate thing that we just talked about. If there's a new law, I could run
that's
you.
That's what I'm telling you.
If I'm behind you and run your plate, but if I'm just
doing,
sitting there, I can't do it.
What police are doing, what that proves, sorry to interrupt.
That's
all
right.
But what that proves is that police are deciding whose license plate to run to check for that information. So if you're driving in the speed limit, you're following all traffic laws, and the cop decides, oh, I'm just going to run this plate and see who's on it and who owns it and what's the status of it. And so my interpretation of that data, Durrell, is that police are making the choice to run African-American plates more often.
They may be. There's another aspect I forgot to mention, is that if you were stopped and you were found to be driving an uninsured vehicle or on a suspended license or a revoked license, do you think the officer will let you get back in that car and drive it?
No. It's
going to
get
towed,
huh?
So what happens? What happens when that occurs? The car, supposedly,
impounded.
The person is given an opportunity to contact somebody to come and get their car. the person generally is hauled over to the jail, okay? And if they can't find anybody to come, a lot of these vehicles are impounded, are towed, okay? Now, we know what it will cost to go back and get your car out of being impounded or being towed. It's maybe $300-$400. I don't know. It's hundreds of dollars. That's another burden. The person who can't drive or pay the ticket, where do a certain majority of those people end up?
In the county.
In the county jail, temporarily, because of minor traffic violations, because they can't pay. The finder don't have the money. So if a person, and I know a story, I read one traffic report of a young black woman who had a child in a back seat and evidently didn't have the child properly strapped in the back. They stopped the car, didn't have insurance. The lady's car was impounded. She was taken to jail. Somebody had to come and get the kid. And she had a job. Now, what's another financial impact?
Lose your job.
You lose your job or the ability to get to work. That is a result of this. And when you look at the numbers, there's a huge number of those types of things that are happening, you know, with poor people that go on there. And there are some what's fascinating, there are some recommendations that the task force is making to the city council to address that type of financial disparity also.
Mm. But Chris wanted to respond to something.
Respond. And then we can get on to some of the drug thing, too.
All right. Well, I've got numbers, too. well, and here's the thing that, you know, we have this aggressive law enforcement apparatus in Champaign County. We've had it like this for about 20 years now. What has been the overall effect on our community having all this aggressive traffic enforcement, aggressive drug war, we are an aggressive drug war county. We prosecute over 1,500 drug cases a year. Mm. We have over, you know,
and those are all like kilos and hundreds of pounds of marijuana and stuff, right?
No, they're not.
No?
No, of course not. You know, and that was a good sarcastic question, so noted. But what the overall effect on our county, when you talk about this constant ticketing, this constant fining, this constant probation, this constant counseling fee, this constant, you know, this drain by the criminal justice system does on a family's finances, what do we have? In 1998, we had 17,753 people living in this county below the poverty line. Now in 2013, we have 40,848, and that's after all this construction.
Right.
I mean, we have all this boom. This is a boom town. I mean, of all the cities outside of Chicago, we're probably the boom town right now.
And so let me take a moment here to say that that's why we're doing this thing called Pathway to Apprenticeship. This informational fair, July 29th, 1:30 to 4:30 at the Douglas Library, 512 East Grove Street. You need to be there. We're working with the East Central Illinois Building Trades, the State Representative Carol Ammon's office, National Council of African American Men, and the Breakfast Club to help diversify and bring more diversity to the building trades in Champaign County so that we can have more African American men and women in particular who are working in these building trades, making significant earnings and living wages, and so that we can start to address some of these disparities that we see from an economic standpoint and the impact that it has on the community from an economic standpoint. Because even if I'm one of these white guys who's a building trades and I get stopped for this speeding ticket, I got $108 to pay. It's not a real big deal for me. I got it on me. Here you go. Right. But if I don't have that, if I'm barely getting by, I can even afford to go to court and fight a drug case if I'm making $23, $30, $35 an hour, right? You know what I'm saying? So the impact that it has on the community is big, y'all. Please make sure you spread the word. Come out to the Pathway to Building Trades Apprenticeship Informational Fair. It is not a job fair, but it is likely that the people who are prepared could possibly end up in the building trades before the summer ends, because there's a lot of construction, a lot of boom that is taking place. If you want more information, give me a call, 721-0934, 721-0934, or you can call State Representative Carol Ammon's office at 217-531-1660, 531-1660. Martell, and then we're going to go to Daryl for this, for some of this drug stuff, so all I can right. look good.
Yes. Oh, okay, when Aaron say boom, we talking about $1,300,000,000 worth of construction in the next in the past 2 years that's happening in Champaign, where the black community ain't seeing probably $1,000,000 of thousands of millions. And I'm going to go back to, we talking about traffic. We don't talk about the court system. And the court system and traffic court, they can have you in traffic court every 2 weeks. And if you don't show up for one of them court hearings, you got a warrant on you. And it's for a traffic violation, for insurance ticket, something. I don't feel this really criminalized. But traffic court, I would love for people just to experience, just go watch traffic court, and you will see the racism in traffic court. I'm telling you, you will witness with your ears and your eyes.
Well, you know, just quickly tying this back together, one of the things that is essential from what I'm hearing for most of the building trades, not all of them, but most of the building trades say you have to have a driver's license in order to actually be an apprentice or to be a journeyman, right? And what do we hear? Suspended license, revoked license, not having your license on you, right? All those things. And of course, we also have, which I have been talking to Carol about, it's absolutely insane from my perspective that you would take a person's driver's license for not paying child support or something like that. Should you pay your child support? Absolutely, you should pay your child support. What the hell my driver's license has to do with trial support? I don't know. It doesn't see how, to me, it's going to make me pay my. It doesn't seem to help me pay my child support when you take my driver's license, right? So that's one of the things that I see happening. And so I just wanted to tie that to your comment that you said about traffic court and all this license suspension and stuff and how it impacts. Now, I'm not, those of you who are repugnantly listening to this conversation and are upset about what sounds like I'm trying to make some excuse for people driving with revoked license or any of that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that prior to that, you have these particular things of profiling. You have these things of taking your license for various different reasons that end up in some of these situations that are not appropriate, that are not beneficial for the community. So, Daryl, what's up with some of this drug stuff?
Yeah, you know, two things. Let me refer people again to the internet. All you need to do is Google Illinois IDOT traffic study, and it will bring up all of the traffic reports that have been done in the last 11 years. The 2014 one was released June 23rd, so it's on the website. And I want to refer to about three pages into the introduction of that report. And one of the things, and this is to clarify the fact that pretextual stops occur, okay? Because we want to make it very clear. In the report, it says, if an officer uses traffic law as a pretext to stop a suspicious vehicle, that stop should be reported to IDOT. Okay? So police departments are supposed to include their pretextual stops in mm-hmm. this information. Mm-hmm. Now, what information is not included is if there's an accident and people are given tickets, citations regarding accidents are not included, or if a car is stopped in the process of handling a crime, like a bank is robbed and you got a description of a car and you're chasing a speeding car and because it's involved in a crime, those traffic stops aren't included. So traffic stops that are part of an ongoing investigation of a crime or accidents are not included. The traffic stop data is supposed to include just vehicle traffic stops and even those pretextual stops. Now, the problem is they request those pretextual stops. And I would, if I had a recommendation for our state representative, Mrs. Ammons, mm-hmm. I would suggest that those are kind of bundled in the data, that I would ask if the state legislator Slaters could possibly request that the police departments separate pretextual stops from regular traffic stops so we could see if there was a racial disparity involving those two types of stops. Because now you can't pull that clearly out of the data. Now, going to the war on drugs, one aspect of this is searches. Because most times when traffic stops involve a search, they are doing that for contraband. It's either because they have suspicion that there's drugs in that car or guns or some illegal possession of that. And I hope everybody...
Or money.
Yeah. I hope everybody understands this is just a fact, okay? This is just data. I'm not taking a position. I'm just reporting it. But when Caucasians are stopped, and for example, the state rate, they made up 50% of the searches in the state of Illinois, but they find contraband 63% of the time. And when African Americans are stopped, they composed 30% of the stops in the state of Illinois, and they only find contraband 25% of the time. Okay? Now, Alexander Wise shared that information with a public policy professor at Berkeley and asked him to look at it and see if what he interpreted that to mean. And I'm just going to read exactly from the report. This could explain some of the disparity, but not all, Professor Glasser said. In examining the data from the Illinois traffic stop study, he argues, it is the outcome of those consent searches that offers the most compelling evidence of racial profiling. He suggests that the disproportionate hit rates strongly indicate that in order for whites in Illinois to be consent searched, they need to meet a higher threshold of suspicion. That simply means the reason they're finding, because we generally know from most studies that the use of drugs is equal among races. There's no great difference in terms of usage and dealing of drugs. But when you conduct traffic stops on white drivers, you find a higher percentage of contraband. It means the officer is using a higher threshold of suspicion and therefore is doing a little bit better job of identifying who might have contraband. But when you stop minority drivers or people of color, and you're discovering contraband at a lower percent, it simply means that you're not doing a very good job of using reasonable suspicion as it. And so what you're doing is you have other suspicions beyond a high level of reasonable suspicion that you're stopping people, is at least represented through consent searches, that they are carrying contraband. And that's, I think, a myth of the drug war in terms of looking at that we have to fight the drug war because the drug war primarily is a war on blacks and not a societal problem. I took Urbana's consent data for the last 10 years and put it in the same graph form, and it is almost identical to the state. The same exact thing is happening in Urbana. That's just what the data is showing. So you can interpret that differently, but you can't refute the data that, in fact, that isn't occurring. So I would suggest, or just for the audience, the question is that tactic really achieving what we want it to accomplish? In other words, do we want our, you know, local police department to use the tactic of pretextual stops when we know there's kind of an implicit bias? There's an implicit bias possibly in training, in our understanding of the drug war and who's using drugs, that it's creating this difference in racial outcomes of traffic stops. But it's basically a negative one that's impacting police community relations and may not be reducing contraband or drugs on our streets.
May not be.
Well, it's not. Well, to the degree, I just, to what most people think.
Okay.
You know.
Well, all right. So I'm not going to get into a debate on my show about okay, whether or not
fine.
I think. No, I'm just kidding with you.
You
no.
can.
Go
fine.
Ahead. Martell, go ahead. You want to respond?
Well, when Daryl said that and he read that, I chuckled. Because if you listen to the data and understand what I see from being a black male, it really ain't about the traffic stop. It's about how to control a set of people. And that's the only way I'm going to look at it. You know, the police is used to keep black people in order. Because it ain't about what we find in crime. Because they got the same data that Daryl's got. So it's another objective they trying to push through the community. And black male sees it that they're going to always be able to stop me because they don't even need no reason because we're making sure that we got our eyes on every black man. That's why I say if you can stop every person that's driving the last 2 years by the way they stopping, and in 2 years' time you stop every driver, you know, it's a means of control.
Chris, you want something?
Well, I rather than speculate like Martell does, although that his speculation is logical, no doubt about it, is, you know,
right?
I'm just curious. As a constituent, I'm a resident of Urbana, and I'm technically one of your constituents, not necessarily in your ward, but do I still qualify?
Absolutely. Okay. I represent the whole city of Urbana.
So I would like my alderman to ask my police chief, why is it you think black people have drugs in the car?
I'll ask him.
That would be a starting point. Because let's not play with the data here. It's the data is the data. Why do you think, why are your officers searching? And the other question I would ask is why does the Urbana, and this goes into more detail about the report, but why does the Urbana Police Department prefer to ticket African Americans instead of issue a warning ticket?
Mm-hmm.
That's another one that needs to be.
So I do think that,
you know,
it raises some questions about can you give a warning ticket for lack of insurance, not having your actual license on you? Can you give a warning ticket for some of those things that Daryl listed? I think it's a legitimate question. We could find out the exact answer. Can you give warnings for some of those things? If you know the economic impact, can you patiently say, listen, all right, so listen, I've stopped you. It's all on video. I can't just let you go. And I know that you have a revoked license, right? So, but I'm going to give you, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, or I'm going to give you the time that I feel like you need, or I'm going to do my best, certainly, to get you, to allow you to get somebody down here to come and get this car so you don't go through this $500 of impoundment fee and all that type of stuff. We got a caller. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. This is Sister Carol calling in.
Good morning, Sister Carol.
I truly appreciate your guest and all the information they just provided. I wanted to ask one question. If Daryl would repeat, because I got to look in the code for the IDOT traffic stop data, where it is, so we can actually put a bill in to separate the information.
Mm-hmm.
So if he could repeat that for me. And then secondly, I have been working on this because we found, as we were trying to do the job piece, that we have a high level of people with either suspended or revoked licenses. But the Secretary of State's office doesn't break the demographics down. And so I'm trying to also create a bill to require that there be a breakdown when people's licenses are suspended or revoked. For what reason? We found that it was like 42,000 plus people just in Champaign County whose licenses are suspended or revoked. And that's a huge number. And so we're trying to figure out what the driver is behind all of the suspensions and revocations. If it's traffic related, what are they? How do they fit into this traffic study that has been going on for 11 years? So we're trying to break it down further to really get at what the problem is, which does lead to people not getting living wage jobs. So I just wanted to see if Daryl could help me break that stuff down, and certainly I'd be happy to put in a bill for the next spring session, get the research done this this fall for that to happen.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your call, Representative. I'm going to ask my guest to call you offline. We have 4 minutes left before we can get up
out
of here.
Well, if he just repeat the one thing.
No, he's going to call you. Goodbye. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It's on the second page of the introduction.
All right. So we've got about 4 minutes left, y'all, before we have to get out of here. And, of course, we knew this hour was going to fly by. And so we could also come back because this is going to be an ongoing thing. Of course, it's going to come to the Urbana City Council. I would encourage Mr. Cruz to read an article called White Boys Loaded. Let's see where that takes you as far as your analysis goes. But anyway, listen, I want to thank the callers for who called in. Again, we want to announce that there's a memorial fund for Mr. Teron Jackson, who was killed earlier this week. And you can go to any of the university credit unions, East University Avenue. You can go to the one on South First Street or the one on campus inside the union and make a cash donation to help support the family through this time. And they're trying to bury their son, their loved one. There's also a car wash benefit that is taking place from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. today over on Madison Bradley at the Family Video. This is to benefit Teron Jackson. And if you go over there and make a donation, you can get your car washed on the corner of Mattis and Bradley at the Family Video. So I want to really encourage people to get out there. And the Pathway to Apprenticeship Building Trades Informational Fair, sponsored by the North End Breakfast Club, AFL-CIO, State Representative Carol Ammons, the Champaign County NAACP, the East Central Illinois Building Trades Commission. Please go out. Please be prepared. Come to this fair. We're going to start registration at 1 p.m. and the event will start at 1:30. This is where you're going to learn the step-by-step process of becoming an apprentice or hopefully a journeyman in one of the trades and be a part of this career choice and an industry that is going to have that's going to be around as long as the country is around, because we have to build stuff. We have to maintain it. So I want to really encourage you all to come out. And if you have any further questions, you can call me at 721-0934 or 531-1660 to the State Representative Carol Ammons' office to get further information. Last shots, Daryl, Martell, anything before we go?
Yeah,
go and stretch out. Don't worry about it.
Real quick, I would like to encourage people to go to the Urbana website again and read a report. There's a series of recommendations at the end of the report, and I want to give credit to Peter Resnick for pulling this report together. But I do want to encourage people to look at that, because the issues we just talked about, there are at least three recommendations that are very, very, I think, progressive. And one is that the committee is requesting the City Council to examine its fine schedule for traffic violations and adjust them so that the fines do not disproportionately impact African and Latino drivers. The city is also the task force encouraging the City Council to investigate programs that will allow lower income drivers to obtain auto insurance more affordably by maybe grouping them. And they're also looking at a moratorium of issuing citations against cannabis possessions when they do a traffic stop. So a lot of the things we've talked about and the problems and issues, many of them are being reflected in the recommendations and also being currently drafted. So if you want to take a look at that and provide some input to refine and improve those, we have about 2 months to do that. So I'd encourage people to do that, because there's some very appropriate, I think, recommendations that are being made by the task force to the City Council.
Okay. Martell?
I'm just going to go with still some time to tell y'all about my radio show on Tuesday.